You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Our guest today is Polly Groves. She has written and published three books, Thomas, Janney, Hannah, and Phineas and His Cousins, about her Quaker ancestors and their journey over the course of 200 years from Cheshire, England, to Philadelphia, Virginia, and finally Minneapolis, Minnesota. Polly has three sons and five grandchildren and one great-grandson. She attended Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and graduated from Metropolitan State University in Minneapolis, where she lived and brought up her family. In 1984, Polly remarried and moved to London to live with her English husband, David Groves. Following her husband's death in 2002, Polly returned to her roots and a condominium overlooking Lake Minnetonka in the western suburbs of Minneapolis. She's an active member of the Guthrie Theater Board of Directors, and best of all are her visits to her children and grandchildren on the West Coast, where she gets involved in their lively activities. She's going to read to us today from her book entitled A London Scrapbook. Please welcome Polly Groves.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you all for being here. Been looking forward to this afternoon, and we're going to have a nice conversation after I start us off with the first page of A London Scrapbook, which tells you a little bit about the scrapbooks and what they're all about. Even on a humid August afternoon, my fireplace glows, crackling with memories that burst from the vellum pages of our scrapbooks, David's and mine. Side by side, these specially bound books, tall and thick, stand touching each other within the polished teak case that nests inside the firebox. The chimney flue has been sealed. The fireplace, a sanctuary of memory, spits out the glowing embers of childhood, fragments of joy and sorrow, clues to secrets deeply buried, glimpses of lives well lived. I close my eyes. I smell the salty air as David and I sail into the Solent from the Beaulieu River along the south coast of England, or feel the afternoon breeze pick up and ruffle the Union Jack flying over the stern of our sloop as we leave the harbor at Porto Ercole. I see the raindrops running off our yellow oilskins. I hear the klaxon of the London taxi, touch the petals of the roses, daisies, and lilies of the Chelsea Green flower stall. The trays of sweets, aubergines, and melons in the markets of the Mediterranean towns, the markets that David loved to photograph. I feel my husband's presence, a hint of his body aroma, a sort of basil, herby smell rising from deep inside his chest. I taste the cool rosé wine from Bandol, remember discovering the path to the vineyard as we threaded our way through a mass of nude bathers sunning on the Med's rocky beach. I touch the wide-brimmed black straw hat I wore to a London wedding and feel his arm around my shoulder. That was another hot August afternoon over 15 years ago. So that begins my tale, my memoir that I wrote really to reflect on the years that I lived in London with my English husband. I think this cover really says a lot, because my husband kept these wonderful Victorian scrapbooks. This began as a hobby, and as he grew older and retired, he spent much more time on it. But they weren't just photograph albums. They were reflecting all that was going on in his life, from political cuttings of what was going on in England to social things. He had passions for certain actresses or something like that, and their lives would be cataloged in his book. And of course his children and grandchildren would have their photographs, but it was more a history of social and political life in London, and he started keeping them after the Second World War, came back from the Navy, and just began to put these things together. So they're just volumes of them. Half of them, when I moved back to the States, half of them I left in London for his children, and then brought half of them back to me. And those are the ones that are lodged in the fireplace that in my condo I never really used, and they're big enough so that I should have brought one. I make that mistake all the time. Well, there's nothing that even, they're, you know, as tall as that amplifier there, and, you know, they're just great big books. And then they're sort of scattered around the rest of my small condo as well. But they are a symbol of our life and a symbol of the joy I felt in London. And also, they are sort of a metaphor for a memoir, you know, a scrapbook holding these bits and pieces of your memory. And so I guess it wasn't too long after I came back that I decided I would begin to write this book. It took several different forms, different names, different, you know, kind of constructions, and it wasn't really going anywhere. And then all of a sudden I decided that the scrapbooks would have to be the theme, and so they were. And I'm just going to tell you, I'm just going to sit here and read you a little bit more, and then we can talk a little bit about risks that you may have taken in your life, and things about the cultural differences between our countries and how it was to adapt to a London life after you've been living in mid-America, which nobody has ever heard of in England. You mentioned Minneapolis and they say Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. Indianapolis. I hear Mary Tyler Moore. Whenever I say that, they say, oh, Mary Tyler Moore.
Oh, yeah, yes, or that. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody's got their own impressions, but it may not be quite what you expected. So, there were lots of things to get used to. So I'm going to read, I've read you the first page, which just tells you about the scrapbooks. Then I'm going to read the second bit here, which gives you a description of when I arrived to stay with him for the first time. We were just getting to know each other, and I had arrived to stay in London and to stay at his flat. I was working at that time for the Humphrey Institute, and they had, just a bit of background, sort of fill you in, they had a program in London. Money had been raised to honor Hubert Humphrey by British politicians on both sides of the political aisle. That was the sort of person Humphrey was. He could do so many things for everybody. So money had been raised at the time that Humphrey died to build a program, a reciprocal program, that would provide funds for civil servants in London or the UK to come to the university to study at the Humphrey Institute and for people to come back over to London as well. But the program hadn't been put in place. It just, the money was there, but there was a board of directors that supervised it all, but it was not operating. So I was working for the Humphrey Institute at this moment, and I had fallen in love with this Englishman. I was in my mid-50s, my children were grown and on their own and married and living on the West Coast where they had gone to college. And of course I had family here and I had my job and I had all these other things that pull one to one's community, but it was time for a big adventure. And I figured out a way that I could take part of my job with me, which had been development director at the Humphrey Institute, and go to London to put this program together. And that's what I did, which worked out wonderfully because I could arrive and sort of hit the ground running, if you know what I mean. I wasn't dependent on my, at that point, boyfriend, or subsequently my husband for anything during the day. I was on my own, I was earning my own money, and I was independent, so that was a good place to be. But here we are. This is June of 1983, and we are beginning to court, and I have arrived in England, and he has taken me to his bachelor flat, which was extremely small. The flat was on the top floor of a two-story building, five flats to each floor. I followed him up the stairs to an outside gallery where his door opened to a cubicle-sized foyer and four doors leading to four tiny rooms. The living room, its bay window overhanging the street, the bedroom, the kitchen, and the bath. In the living room, or as the English call it, sitting room, David had arranged the furniture. The sofa's now snug against the square center table pushed to the west wall. Under the bow window, a long marble-top table held a stereo-radio combination. Books were stacked on several other smaller tables, and lamps lit the paintings that covered every inch of wall space. He led me into the bedroom with its double bed, a desk, and two tall French bureaus. "Would you like to unpack?" He pointed to several empty bureau drawers. "I've made some space there, and you can hang your dresses in the hall closet." So I began moving my clothes into place. We bumped into each other. But I didn't mind his tiny bachelor flat. It felt cozy. Now, here comes the first bit of tension. Then I saw him frown as he studied my dresses. "Is that what you brought?" he asked, eyeing the red cotton summery dress, one of my favorites. "The women will be in black." "But it's summer," I said, dismayed by his show of disappointment. "It doesn't matter," he said firmly. "In London, black's the fashion." Oh dear, I'll look so suburban. My heart contracted as I realized I was off to a poor start. But he smiled and said reassuringly, "Don't worry, you'll be all right." We were to attend two cocktail parties that very night, he explained, and what I'd brought along would have to do. It would have to be. As a working woman, I wore suits and blouses. Remember those days back then when working women were that way? Gray pinstripe suits and shoes and blouses. My few summer dresses, appropriate for Minnesota patio parties, were not designed for international capital city society. And later that evening, as I left the flat dressed in my red cotton, I felt like Dorothy from Kansas setting out, naive and unprepared, on the yellow brick road. As we were driving to the party, David offered instructions. "Avoid walking around the room saying, 'Hello, I'm Polly Brown.' No one in London cared for those sorts of details," he explained. And as we made our way down the Royal Hospital Road to Cheney Walk, my apprehension grew. Dorothy, alone and without guides, that was me. We arrived at Johnny Churchill's house, and David swept us inside, introducing me to a few people clustered near the door. Then by himself, he headed for a group across the room. I smiled sweetly as I turned to a silver-haired, blue-suited man and asked something like, "What was the most exciting thing you did today?" But by the time we'd been at Johnny's place for an hour, I felt I'd learned how to behave, though that was the same night I asked a partygoer where he liked to travel, only to learn he was the Swiss ambassador to the United Kingdom. I listened to conversations about the approaching general election and a certain victory for Margaret Thatcher and the Tories, and I began to understand this wasn't the warm, fuzzy Midwestern nest where I had lived all my life, where I was a leader. Here I was an unknown, only David Groves's American girlfriend, his new girlfriend. So that's the way I began that adventure. And one thing led to another, and in about a year and a half, no, actually that was 83. Yeah, a year and a half, I was on my way looking like this when I arrived in Gatwick Airport with all my goods and chattels.
Fresh-faced?
Yes, exactly. I had divided up all my possessions with my children, thinking I would never be back, and that was okay. That was the way it went. So the book is full of photographs that capture London life and also capture the essence of the backstory of my life in Minnesota as a child and growing up here and bringing up my children in my career that I had. So that's what this is. A memoir is totally different from an autobiography, as you know. I mean, that's just sort of linear, I was born and blah, and you go on like this. But this travels in so many different circles. You can start the way I did with the first memorable event, and then move on, and then go back, and then retrace, and then dive deeply. One thing you can't be afraid to do is to be perfectly honest, and and absolutely frank about things. There's no room for fuzzy thought here. You've got to put down how you feel. So that was my adventure in my early 50s. And I don't know whether you can relate to that in terms of adventures that you embarked on at your age or how you can think about that, but there's a time in life where I think taking a risk can be very fulfilling. It can be so challenging that you have to have, you know, good backing behind you, good support. You can't just go off, and particularly nowadays in this economic time that we're living through where you don't have the security of the funds that we perhaps had back then. Can I answer any questions about anything like the differences of transferring myself from America to Great Britain? It was absolutely wonderful living in London. I still miss it. You know, living in a great big city where there's a temperate climate and flowers are being sold on street corners and not just in supermarkets, and you've got the hustle and bustle of so many different kinds of people and people speaking all kinds of different languages and the transportation that takes you this way and that way through the city, and you can sit on the underground and listen to all these voices speaking languages that you have no command of yourself. And I really miss that in many ways. But I couldn't have, after David died, even though we had friends and his family's there, and I'm able to get back to visit once a year, at least for a week or so, I'm sad to go back because I'm a visitor now. I don't live there. And I thought that I'd be able to manage a kind of a transatlantic life somehow after he died, that I'd be able to live there and be able to come here and go back and forth and sort of share two places. But I don't think one can do that. One has to be in one place. And I realized that living in London as a widow was not going to be comfortable for me. We have a society here which is much more open in terms of accepting single women and, you know, and older women. And you could just, this is where I grew up. This is where my roots are. This is where I really belong. And particularly with my children here and my grandchildren, I can get to them easily and they can come through, and it's just better to be here.
They're on the West Coast.
They're on the West Coast. They stayed there after college, and that's fine. You know, we're a close family, but that's where they are. But
so you were in London for 20 years?
Almost 20 years, yeah.
What was this different when you came back? I suppose you've been traveling.
I've been back and forth, I would come back usually over Thanksgiving, and then maybe Memorial Day the following year, and that was sort of my pattern. So I saw my kids at least twice a year. I think I wouldn't have been able to go to have made that change if I didn't have the ability to come back. I couldn't have just gone. You know, it's just would have been too difficult to do. Exactly. It was hard to, you know, put all that together, but it really worked. And there were just some. It really worked so well. I have a piece here about my mother, who died in 1999. And my father had been ill for many years, and mother cared for him at home. But here's just a little bit about her character. This is in a chapter I've written, which is called Mother. And it just tells the story about my tremendous affection for her. Mother set an example, and I observed her carefully. Throughout her life, Mother planned each day with precision, and at the end of their lives, my parents continued to be an impregnable union. When I close my eyes, I see my mother preparing Father for a twice daily car ride, releasing first his fists, then smoothing his hair and tilting his cap. Mother lived for 9 years after my father's death.
but during the last 12 years of his life as an invalid, she was saying goodbye to him quietly and stoically. Occasionally, she shed a private tear, ones that we would only see if we entered her bedroom, find her standing by the window, overlooking her garden. So, you know, this is the way she was. She would never have written a memoir. She would have kept everything to herself. She was, you know, a stoic person. I really never saw her shed a tear more than once or twice in my life, whereas I cry at the drop of a hat. It doesn't take much to turn me on. And I resemble my father's side of the family. That's the Quaker side of the family. That's where the sort of whimsy and humor and joy comes into it all as well. So it was fun to try to trace as I was reflecting on my own new marriage in London, to try to look at my parents' marriage and how it had become such a strong union in spite of my father's illness and what they'd been able to do together all those years. So that's the story of them. I think there's a lot in here about sailing as well. That was such a tremendous hobby of my husband's, and he had a sailboat that he kept on the south coast of England, which was, I mentioned in that first story, talk about the Union Jack flying from the stern of the boat. And we went down for almost every weekend. Our flat was so small that it was fun to get away on the weekends and sail on the sailboat, so we did that. And it was a great joy. And then after he retired, he bought a larger boat that we kept in the Mediterranean, and it had a different port each winter. But we would spend, because I was working, obviously, the people in Great Britain take long summer holidays. So, sort of in August, there was nothing really going on. We could be gone the whole month of August, and I wasn't missing anything going on in London. So,
we need that here.
Yeah, we need that here. My children don't have any vacation. I don't think anybody has one now. You know, we do need that here. Everybody needs. They still do that in Britain. I know my husband's grandchildren, when their spouses are there, August is a holiday time. Take their children and go somewhere for 3 weeks and take a house somewhere, you know. And these aren't wealthy people. These are people who are working hard, but they save up and do that, and these advantages are there. So.
No guilt, because everybody's doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Everybody's doing it. Have any of you traveled to London? Have you been there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With school or with...
I was a study abroad, so I was there for 4 months.
Oh, what fun.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you? Were you...
South Kensington.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
It was beautiful.
Just where we live.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
What, were you studying at some particular school there, or...?
It was through the university.
Yeah. Through the university, mm-hmm, here, yeah.
It was literature and theater, so a lot of the other kids had internships in the theaters,
right,
locally, so...
Oh, what... Well, I know. This is it. Mm-hmm. This is... what I really miss, that you can get to so many different venues.
Every night.
Every night. Just hop on the underground, mm-hmm, hop on a bus, you don't even have to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Were you living right there? Can you remember where you were living?
Yeah, it was right on Cromwell.
Oh, right, Cromwell,
yeah,
Place.
Right in the corner where it's Earl's Court.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's perfect.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. Last winter, Gary Gieselman, who teaches at St. Olaf's, mm-hmm, and also has directed plays at Jan Hassen and the Guthrie Theater, had read my memoir, and he liked it so much, he takes a group of his drama students, it's just interterm students. They didn't have to necessarily be studying drama, but he takes them to London for the month of January. And they go to the theater, and they just immerse themselves in theater. And they're all staying up in Regent's Park and going to the college there, having classes. And he asked me if I would come make my visit last January to London and spend time with him and his students. So I stayed up there and attended his classes in the morning. And then we went to the theater in the afternoon, sometimes the evening. And then the next morning, we'd talk about it all. And it was so much fun. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you can relate to all of that, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even the small theater and the little independent theaters, it's amazing to see them.
I know.
And it didn't have to be the very expensive production.
No. The new work just done, I don't know if you are interested in theater the way I am. I've actually been writing some plays about London. I had my plays, I say plays, it's really three acts in one play. It's called London Concerto. It was read last night at the Playwrights Center by a group of professional actors. And it, you know, just takes not anything from here particularly, although I do started out with that first story about coming to David's flat and saying, don't go around the room, you know, telling everybody you're Polly Brown, nobody cares. And they don't, really. That's all. They don't.
What do you say?
You know, I mean, you know, when we introduce ourselves, we say, how do you do? And you give me your name and I give you my name. No, they just sort of like this. It just sort of all happened. And then after we were married, he had this habit of going into a party and somebody would come up, a couple that I didn't know, and he'd say to them, you know my wife. End of it all. And then I'd have to say, yes, I'm his wife, I'm Polly Groves, you know, and extend my hand. And maybe they'd give me their names, maybe they wouldn't. So, you know, it's just sort of the way it was. It's so different because we everything here in this country is just right out front, you know. That's the way we are.
So did you run out and buy black?
Yes, I ran. Oh, my dress looks so terrible. It was just fine for the summer of 1983 on somebody's 4th of July party, but it sure didn't go well. Now, of course.
Well, you were a career person here.
Yeah.
Stay-at-home mom.
Exactly. I was comfortable in that kind of thing here. Yeah. But now, you know, we've all got black and everything, whatever. But back to the theater bit, the small theater companies and the Royal Court and some of these others are just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So.
Well, so many students do study abroad now. I mean, it's almost.
No. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. It's amazing the programs that are provided through
so
even at
the
high school level a semester or something. Mm-hmm. Have you been to London? Have you traveled a lot? Well, it's all there, waiting for you. What about you? How about your experiences?
In my undergraduate, one of our theater classes for the theater majors, we went to New York for about 3 weeks, and all we did was see shows.
Yes.
So that was like heaven.
Just heaven.
Like you just like shows, like matinee, evening matinee, exactly. And that was fabulous. And then our choir in undergrad was internationally renowned, so we would go on like a 3.5 week European tour. So we'd go to Europe and South Africa, and we'd stay in people's homes, and we'd sing in cathedrals, and we. That was cool. So
wonderful. That what was it? The university choir?
I went to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa.
Yes.
So I'm from Iowa. So.
Yeah.
And then a few of my friends. And my friend Mary Kate actually just graduated with her theater major, and she is going to grad school in England. She's going. Birmingham,
yes.
Yeah, so that's where she is right now. She just moved like a month ago.
Exciting.
That's
a nice story.
Yeah.
How many years ago was that you did this?
I'm in my second year of master's now, so it was probably about 2 or 3 years ago.
Right. And what are you doing your master's in?
Voice performance. I'm an opera singer.
Oh, wonderful. Have you done any work with the Minnesota Opera?
I just finished. I am doing chorus work with them this year, so we just finished Orfeo y Eurydice.
Yes.
With David Daniels, which was fabulous.
Yeah, wonderful.
So it was great. But and my voice teacher has actually done a bunch of German coaching at the Guthrie this year.
Oh yes, for Master Builder.
Yeah.
Master Butchers.
Yeah. Master Butchers Singing Club. And then they're doing another play that they needed a bunch of German words. They wanted to make sure they had the right pronunciations, so she's coming in and do stuff for that too, so.
Maybe that's 39 steps. I don't know. You know, I'm very active at the Guthrie, so I'm there a lot.
I'm excited about 39 steps.
Yeah,
it's supposed to
be fun.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I wonder if that's it, because there's so many different components to that. Mm-hmm. It could be the German words. Yeah, that's going to be wonderful. Mm-hmm. So, I'd like to hear about everybody. Your travels? Have you been to London?
I haven't. I would love to go.
well, their opportunities are there. It's, you know, air travel is not as easy as it used to be. We all know that. But it's the way it goes. That's the way you get there. And it's wonderful. What about you? Have you traveled?
Yeah, I travel, but I never go to London, but
exactly.
If I have a chance, I will visit the city.
Right, right. Well, there's plenty to get done here. There's no doubt about it. It's wonderful. We're just talking about life experiences and taking risks in midlife and that kind of thing, which I did with my life and wrote this memoir. So we're just having a conversation about it all. You're nice to come on a sunny day like this. You never know who's...
How do you define midlife?
Well, it can be defined in any way that you wish, I think. For me, it was probably when I made this decision and took this risk, and that was when I was I was 51 years old. And that's a while ago. So that was midlife for me. And now my youngest son is 51 years old, so.
We'll have to wait until I get to be midlife.
Yeah.
That's a joke. Wait,
well, jokes are what make us all tie together, I think. Humor is the, you know, the bomb of our existence. I think one has to have a good sense of humor. Well, I'd love to talk more if you have questions you want to ask or anything you'd like to bring up. I think I've covered the subjects in the book. I think I know that the memoir sort of has resonates with all ages. Men like it as well as women because it reads so well. I mean, I shouldn't say that, but I'm actually promoting my book, of course, here. But it does read well, and if people, you know, can sort of sit down and read it over a night or something like that. So it's been fun to talk to groups and fun to meet new people and what have you. So,
are your husband's scrapbooks going to be published?
No, what could happen with them would be if there was a display or some sort of an exhibition of Victorian scrapbooks. Then they would go and, you know, be on display and people could look at them. And you know, they cover periods in the back. They've got labels that say, you know, 1982 to 84 or something. That each one was about a 2-year volume. You just put so much in them. But they were arranged sort of topically, not necessarily chronologically. In other words, if he was following racehorses or something, he'd have the big race. Kentucky Derby, and he'd have something else, then you might have a grandchild riding a horse or something like that, you know, and then inserting all these different ideas and things in there. Or a political cartoon that was particularly devastating to one of the politicians that he didn't like very much. I had that just all circled and, you know, in there and saying, this, I would have said this too, or I could have drawn this better maybe, or something like that. So, you know, that was sort of the way. It was all filled with humor. And then sometimes you'd ask other people if there was a certain section about people or about a trip that was meaningful. People came to dinner, you'd have them sign something, you know, some little something in the, on that page.
So did he share them with people, or was it mostly his own?
It was mostly his own, but they were people, they were talking points. I mean, you couldn't help but come into our house and see these volumes in a book, a special bookcase. And so friends knew that he was a scrapbooker of this kind. And so they would ask, you know, to look at one or something like this. And this got to be a little old sometimes for me, because the asking came after a dinner party. British people have people to dinner a lot, and they do their own cooking, and they come to you cook for 6 or 8 people. And we had this square center table I described when I first met him that we took to our second flat, which was slightly larger, but in the same area, Chelsea Green. And And so, you know, you'd cook dinner, and they wouldn't come until about 8 o'clock at night, and you'd have maybe drinks for just 20 minutes or so, not long, and then you'd serve dinner, and then there'd be conversation. And now it's about 10:30 at night, and, you know, you're going to work in the morning, and somebody says, let me see your scrapbook. And I'd go, smile, and then out would come the volume. The table would be cleared, and the scrapbooks would go on the table, and, you know, Joe and Mabel would sit there and look at them, and they'd all comment, and I would sit there too. So that happened.
I don't know if you talked to me, Mabel, or if you have already covered this. I'm sorry, I was lost. But as I approach the end of life, when you look back, you know, you have, when you realize that you have less days to live than you have, there is a peacefulness that comes over you, at least over me. And I look at myself every so often, and without any conscious purpose, all this knowledge comes to me about life. Oh, like I'm figuring out things that you only realize then, and you have to do anything to get there. It just comes to you. And do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about.
Do you have any experience about that to share with us?
I think you've described it very well yourself, in terms of understanding where you are on life's path, and that you do have fewer days ahead than you did before, but there is a kind of sorting out process, that some things are more important than other things. I'm just trying to, you know, to find some exact examples for you. I think it just becomes, there is a peacefulness about it all. And a sort of realization that you can take the time to reflect. And I guess what I've realized, may sound sort of silly to you, but, you know, we were all brought up with that ethic that, you know, there's the work day, you do these certain things, and after those things are done, it's the end of the day, and then certain other things happen, and then we maybe can start to read a book, or have some fun, or do something. Well, you know, now I've given myself permission. I think we can give ourselves permission. Given myself permission to take up a book after lunch, and read it, not have to wait till, you know, the evening. Take it up after lunch and read it. As long as you want. And don't have to be, but of course I'm writing and I'm doing these things and I'm working on this project and that project. But put it aside, you know, it'll be there when you finish, and maybe you'll get some insights into something new that you're reading. So this year is the first time I've really given myself permission to change that daily schedule. So that's as close as I can come. I'll probably think of more things later, but I understand what you're saying.
I wonder if anybody else does. So I don't want to have a conversation or two. I would like to have a conversation.
No, this is fun. We're all having a conversation, and I don't want to keep anybody too long because it is such a nice day. So. If you'd like to buy my book, I'd love to sign it for you, and we can take it away, and there's Terry, and we can walk by Andrew, maybe say something into the microphone that'll be on iPod, who knows. But I don't want to keep anybody any longer. So you're more than welcome. I've enjoyed talking to you very much.